I'd like to do a bit of a disclaimer here. I'm actually reporting on a study that was conducted by my colleagues at Swift Current, and I was basically just drafted here to be the messenger. So I'll defer any difficult questions. You can send them by email to Con Campbell or Fernando Celis, but I'll take the simple ones. Again, I'm talking about a study that was done in Swift Current, Saskatchewan, looking at phosphorus use efficiency in a long-term study that was started in 1967. And of course, this is important because phosphorus is a critical nutrient for crop growth. It's a structural component of the nucleotides, nucleic acids, and phospholipids. So it's essential for all energy relations in the plant. It's necessary for all growth processes, and agronomically, it promotes root development, it promotes tillering, early flowering, seed production, and uniform ripening. So we have to have an adequate supply of phosphorus present in the system very early in plant growth in order to attain optimum crop yield. So phosphorus fertilization is a major input for crop production on the Canadian prairies and, of course, everywhere else in the world. And low phosphorus recovery is a major economic and environmental concern. Now, we know and we've heard a lot recently about peak phosphorus. Phosphorus is a non-renewable resource, and phosphorus reserves are limited. So whether that limitation is 50 years, 100 years, 300 years, or 1,000 years, it's still a limited resource, and we have a responsibility to use that resource effectively. Also, as was mentioned earlier, phosphorus does move into water systems, and when it does, it leads to serious environmental impacts. Eutrophication, bacterial growth, fish kills, impeded navigation and fishing, and reduced recreational value. This here is the beach on Lake Winnipeg, north of Winnipeg, Manitoba, and that's not the kind of recreational area you want when you're going swimming at your beach. Also, phosphorus fertilizers do contain trace elements. There's beneficial elements like zinc and iron, but there's also harmful elements like cadmium, uranium, and thallium. And these harmful elements can accumulate in the soil over time, leading to negative effects on soil microorganisms and possibly the risk of transfer into the food chain. And so we'd like to reduce the accumulation of these negative elements in the soil. So that brings up the question then, how efficiently is phosphorus fertilizer being used in spring wheat systems, and for us on the Canadian prairies is what we're concerned about. Now, as was mentioned earlier, it's estimated that the efficiency of phosphorus use in the year of application is quite inefficient, less than 30% for sure. So the question then comes, what happens to the other 70%? Is it lost by runoff or erosion and then poses an environmental problem and it's lost irreversibly? Is it converted to other forms of varying solubility that are unavailable for plant growth? Is it incorporated into the soil organic matter or microbial biomass, and then it can cycle through and become available later on? Can it be used by subsequent crops? And the fate of that missing phosphorus is really important because it will affect our fertilizer management strategy. If the phosphorus remains available for crop uptake, replacement strategies will be effective. You do a balancing, you put in what you're taking out. On the other hand, if the phosphorus is lost or if it's rendered unavailable, greater phosphorus inputs will be needed. And that means more rapid depletion of those phosphorus reserves, an increased risk of trace element accumulation, and a greater risk of phosphorus movement to waterways through erosion. The soil particles themselves are carried over, moves into waterways where they can become available. Now, if we look at the long-term basis, crop removal and replacement of phosphorus seems to be relatively well balanced in the Canadian prairie situation. This is some information that was collected by Adrian Johnston for Manitoba between 1965 and 2006, where he looked at phosphorus removal in the crop offtake and phosphorus added as fertilizers and manures. And you can see that on the long-term basis over those years, they're fairly closely balanced. So this really seems to indicate relatively high fertilizer or phosphorus use efficiency, and, you know, in spite of that 30% figure we hear thrown around. So Fernando Celis and Con and the group at Swift Current decided that they wanted to take a closer look at this on the prairie condition and to look at the long-term availability of phosphorus that was added over time to our spring wheat cropping systems. And they did this on a long-term study that they had set up to determine the effect of cropping frequency and nitrogen fertilization on long-term phosphorus use efficiency by spring wheat. And they looked at it a little bit more closely so that they could evaluate the availability of residual phosphorus that had been accumulated over 27 years of phosphorus addition for spring wheat. Now, this crop rotation fertility experiment was conducted from 1967 to 2005 at Swift Current, Saskatchewan, which is right down there in the bottom close to the border. The characteristics of the Swift Current site are it is a semi-arid brown soil zone area. It's at about 50 degrees north. It's an aridic haploborol, or in the Canadian system of soil classification, it's a Norfolk brown Chernozem. The area is primarily used for production of spring wheat and durum wheat. Those are the standard crops, although other crops like canola and pulse crops are coming in more and more. Now, crop production is normally moisture limited, so summer fallow is often part of the rotation. Summer fallow frequency has been decreasing, but it still is commonly a part of the rotation in this area. And the crops are normally nitrogen limited. Even on a summer fallow crop, you usually get a good response to application of nitrogen fertilizer. So in the study that they set up in 67, they looked at two rotations, a fallow wheat-wheat rotation and a continuous wheat rotation. I guess that's using rotation kind of liberally, but continuous wheat system. Each phase was present each year, and over those rotations, they superimposed two fertility treatments, annual fertilization with nitrogen and phosphorus, or with phosphorus alone. They had three replicates of a 0.04 hectare plot size. And then in 1993, they split each of those plots, and three quarters of each plot continued to receive fertilizer phosphorus as before, while a quarter received no additional fertilizer phosphorus. Now, each year they seeded recommended cultivars of spring wheat. Field operations were conducted with commercial farm equipment. Weed control was with stubble, mulch, tillage, and recommended herbicide applications. The summer fallow plots received about four tillage operations each year, and in each plot, the straw was chopped and returned to the plots after harvest. Soil samples were taken at the 0 to 15 centimeter depth each spring prior to field operations and in mid-October after harvest and before freeze-up. And after 1994, samples were also taken at the 0 to 7.5 and 7.5 to 15 to more closely monitor the changes in phosphorus. Two cores per plot were combined and analyzed for nitrate, nitrogen, and Olsen P. Fertilizer management, they used ammonium nitrate, they broadcast it, and soil incorporated it just prior to seeding, and they followed the Saskatchewan soil recommendations for nitrogen. So from 1967 to 1989, it was based on soil nitrate to 60 centimeters plus fertilizer phosphorus to equal 65 kilograms of nitrogen per hectare. And then from 1990 onwards, the fertility recommendations changed in the province because there was getting to be higher yield potential and probably more depletion in nitrogen in the system. So the rate was increased to 90 kilograms per hectare of total nitrogen for wheat that was grown on the summer fallow and 73 kilograms for wheat grown on stubble. And the phosphorus source was monoammonium phosphate, which is the standard source of phosphorus on the prairies, and it was seed placed with wheat at about 9 to 10 kilograms of phosphorus per hectare on all fertilized treatments. So, of course, with the continuous wheat, there was phosphorus applied every year, and in the summer fallow wheat-wheat system, it was applied to the wheat phase. Wheat was harvested when ripe. The full P and the without P areas were sampled separately after the split occurred. They determined yield on a 50 by 40 meter swath in the middle of the crop treatments using a conventional combine, and a 2.32 meter square area was hand harvested to determine the nitrogen and phosphorus concentration in the grain and straw using a Technicon system after 87. Now then, they looked at phosphorus use efficiency using the balance method as Johnny was talking about before. So they looked at phosphorus in the grain plus phosphorus in the straw divided by the fertilizer phosphorus plus the phosphorus that was returned in the straw. Now, since the phosphorus in the straw and the phosphorus returned in the straw are pretty well awash, This is approximately equal to 100 times phosphorus in the grain over phosphorus, or over the fertilizer phosphorus that was added. Now, this really does require long-term data for proper assessment to look at it in the long-term as opposed to the short-term. So this study that was established in 1967 was really sort of an ideal forum to look at this. Now, the original plots were treated as a randomized complete block design with replicates and rotational treatments as main plots and year groupings as subplots, and I'll talk about that a little bit later. The data for exclusion plots that were started in 1993 were analyzed, again, using a randomized complete block with nested design, again, rotations and p-treatments as main plots, year groupings, subplots, and they looked at the difference between the plus p and the minus p with those were tested with single degrees of freedom comparisons. Trends in Olson P were analyzed using regression analysis, linear and plateau model with spline regression, and the effect of the crop rotation fertilizer combinations were separated in the linear part of the curve using linear regression and indicator values for the non-numeric variables. Now, the study was actually evaluated over three different time periods, and this is because there was a little bit different weather conditions that occurred during these three stages. From 1967 to 1979, it was a relatively dry period, and when you looked at the water deficit, which is calculated with a spring soil water plus precipitation minus pan evaporation during the growing period from May 1st to August 31st, water deficit was about 750 millimeters. In 1980 to 1993, it was a little wetter period. Water deficit was a little lower, 726 millimeters, but slightly higher CV. And from 94 to 2005, it was quite a moist period, if you can talk about swift current as being moist, but it was about 607 millimeters of deficit for the water. So on average, the deficit over the whole period was about 700. But again, the water deficit in the first period was high because of consistently high temperatures and low precipitation in the growing season. The second period was quite a bit more variable. There were three quite severe droughts in 84, 85, and 88 growing seasons. But for the most part, the yields around those years were quite good. And the third period had a smaller moisture deficit and higher yield potentials overall. So grain yield followed those trends in water deficit, with period three having a higher yield than period two, having a higher yield on average than period one. Now, grain production was also lower for the fallow wheat than the continuous wheat because of the lack of the yield in the fallow year, because there was no crop grown. Yield was higher with nitrogen fertilizer, especially on the continuous wheat. And so this really indicates that, as we are aware in this environment, yield is moisture and nitrogen limited primarily. So the highest grain production did occur with good moisture conditions in that 94 to 2005 period with the application of nitrogen fertilizer and with continuous cropping. And here I'm talking about the total grain production over the period. So it's not annual yield or the yield in kilograms per hectare in any year. It's the cumulative year over that yield over that period. So in that 1994, high nitrogen inputs and continuous cropping, we had the highest total grain production. And of course, the phosphorus offtake very closely related to the grain offtake, phosphorus offtake yield times the concentration of phosphorus in the grain. And so again, the highest offtake with that high nitrogen continuous wheat, and also after 1994, reflecting the higher yield potential because of the higher moisture availability. Now, phosphorus use efficiency also was related to that total grain yield. So phosphorus use efficiency increased with good moisture conditions, nitrogen fertilizer, and continuous cropping. And with good growing conditions, almost all of the phosphorus that was applied was removed by the crop over time. So we had almost 100% use efficiency with those good growing conditions over the time period of the study. And again, this implies very little actual immobilization of the phosphorus over time. It seemed that the phosphorus that was being applied in fertilizer was remaining in available form where the crops could access it and remove it. So that balance seemed to be very close, very tight. Now, Olson P was higher in the continuous wheat than in the fallow wheat because there was greater fertilizer input with continuous cropping because we're putting on fertilizer, phosphorus fertilizer, 3 years out of three instead of only 2 years out of three. So we see that higher level where we have the continuous wheat. We also saw an increase in soil phosphorus, Olson phosphorus, over time. So we had this accumulation again, because there still was some retention, but it was being retained in the available form. And again, we saw more Olson P without nitrogen than with nitrogen, because in the nitrogen limitation, nitrogen fertilization increased the offtake, and again, we saw less going into the Olson P form and more being taken off in the crop. So the increase in Olson P over time from 1967 through to 2005, the entire period of the study, reflected the fertilizer added and the phosphorus balance in P input minus P removal. So we had the highest Olson P, where we had continuous wheat with phosphorus fertilizer and with no nitrogen, because we had a much higher phosphorus, positive phosphorus balance. In contrast, our lowest was with fallow wheat. We had less total phosphorus applied. We had a much smaller phosphorus balance and lower phosphorus measurable in the Olson P. Now, we did see a very good relationship then between the phosphorus balance and the Olson P that we were measuring. So again, there's a gradual increase, a positive relationship between Olson P and the P balance. But when you get to the zero P balance, when all of a sudden we're starting to put on a P surplus, you can see that there's quite a break in the line and a much more rapid increase with changes in the P balance when we're in a positive system as compared to a negative system. And I think this is quite interesting. So again, the second half of the study, from 1994 on, the plots were split and P was withheld on a portion of each plot. And they compared, comparisons were made between the plots that received phosphorus through the entire period and the plots where P was withheld over the last 12 years of the study. So depletion was assessed after 27 years of building and 12 years of depletion. Now, I guess the first question that any farmer would have was what's happening on to my grain yield. And it's interesting that the effect of withholding phosphorus on grain yield from 1994 to 2005 was not really large or consistent. So when you looked at it over the average of the 12 years from 1994 to 2005, there was a difference in yield, but it was primarily under the continuous wheat and where there was a good nitrogen supply. There was much less effect on the fallow wheat, and this may be just because there's less offtake, or it may be because we are seeing some mineralization of phosphorus from the crop residue and the soil microbial biomass because of the fallow period. And the differences in these years, it wasn't that there was a yield increase each year. Some years there was a good response, and some years there was nothing. But on average, there was a little benefit under continuous wheat. So this, again, has some implications when you're looking at fertilizer management from a farmer's viewpoint. Because crop yield often was optimized based just on the residual phosphorus that was there in the soil, producers might be able to reduce their phosphorus inputs in years where fertilizer prices are high or grain prices are low without having a very large impact on their crop yield. And so that gives them some more management options. So again, if you've got a good soil that's resilient in terms of phosphorus supply, you can maybe manage over the rotation or manage over a few years rather than managing just from year to year. But again, there has to be a reserve of residual phosphorus there to tap into. So phosphorus removal needs to be balanced with phosphorus replacement in the long term if you're wanting to avoid depletion. The other thing to note is that there can still be a starter effect in cold years. This is a photo that was taken a few years ago by Aaron Baldwin, who works with Cargill. And this was a farmer's field, and the whole field had received banded phosphorus in the fall. He did a multi-nutrient band in the fall. But he came in, and this side received cedro phosphorus, and the other side received no starter phosphorus. And on this cold prairie soil, there was a very strong pop-up effect, or a strong starter effect. So that has to be kept in mind, and maybe in terms of management, there may be different management dynamics if you're seeding early onto a cold soil as if, than if you're seeding a little bit later onto a warmer soil, potentially. Now, of course, the effect of withholding phosphorus on phosphorus removal from 1994 to 2005 really mirrored the effect on grain yield, because basically you're either putting phosphorus in or not, and you're taking it out in the grain. And so, again, the biggest effect on in terms of phosphorus offtake was on the continuous wheat. And when we looked at the phosphorus balance between 1994 and 2005, it was very highly negative where phosphorus was not applied. Again, of course, you're taking it off. We're not having a big impact on yield, but we're not putting on any phosphorus. So we've got a very strongly negative phosphorus balance. So this, again, indicates that the crop was accessing residual phosphorus that had built up over time and was able to maintain its crop yield by accessing that available plant-available phosphorus in the soil. Now, the phosphorus balance, if we looked at it, instead of just looking at it in the period from 1994 where the phosphorus application was ceased, but we looked at it for the entire time period of this study from 67 to 2005, the phosphorus balance was positive where phosphorus had been applied continuously and was actually very close to zero where the phosphorus application had ceased. So nearly all of the phosphorus that we had applied in the first 27 years was recovered by the crop in that 12 years after phosphorus was stopped, as long as nitrogen was adequate. So if the system was not nitrogen limited, the crop was able to extract the phosphorus that was there in the soil. Again, when we looked at the Olsen phosphorus, it reflected the P balance very closely. So it declined in the plots that did not receive phosphorus, and it increased in the plots that had a high phosphorus input. However, I think it's still important to note that the Olsen phosphorus at the end of the study was still higher than it was at the beginning. So the high phosphorus use efficiency that we were seeing was not necessarily due to the depletion of native phosphorus, but rather seemed to be due to the utilization of the phosphorus that we'd been applying as fertilizer. So when we looked at the trends or the slopes of those lines, again, they very, very closely related to the phosphorus balance. This is where phosphorus had been applied through the entire period, and this was where phosphorus, the other column is where phosphorus was withheld. And again, the highest positive slope occurred with the continuous wheat, where phosphorus had been applied but not nitrogen, and much more negative slopes where the phosphorus had been withheld, because again, we were mining the phosphorus that we had applied over time. And nitrogen accentuated things to some extent. Where phosphorus was withheld, wheat recovered the phosphorus accumulated over time, so our phosphorus use efficiency from 1967 to 2005 was very high. And in fact, recovery of phosphorus by the plant was nearly 100%, again, especially where nitrogen was not limiting. Cumulative phosphorus efficiency increased over time due to improved growing conditions, so those better moisture conditions in that last period helped increase the phosphorus use efficiency. So removing other limitations improved the phosphorus use efficiency. And that's especially true with continuous wheat and with nitrogen application. So just to go through some final conclusions from this study, total phosphorus removal was similar to total phosphorus input as long as the crop was not nitrogen limited. Utilization of the phosphorus fertilizer was very, very high when we assessed it over time. So the balance calculation really provides a better estimate of phosphorus use efficiency than does recovery in the year of application. So it's probably closer to 100% than it is to the 25 to 30 we've been talking about. Crops can attain optimum yields by using that residual phosphorus, as long as there is residual phosphorus there for them to access effectively. And again, as Mike was pointing out, as long as the movement into the available phase forms is rapid enough to satisfy the crop demand. So producers can take advantage of this in the short term when fertilizer prices are high relative to grain prices. Again, we need to balance input and offtake over time to avoid depletion. And the starter response may still occur, especially on cold soils, again, where that replenishment of the soil solution and where root growth is limited because of those cold soil conditions. Under the semi-arid prairie conditions, phosphorus fertilizer was not transformed into unavailable forms, but rather remained in an available form for crop uptake. The phosphorus use efficiency was much higher than is often stated in the literature and certainly supports the observations of Sires et al. In their 2008 paper. And a replacement strategy for phosphorus fertilizer can be used to optimize crop yield while preventing long-term depletion of our soil phosphorus reserves. And finally, I'd like to thank IPNI for their support and also the many technicians who worked over the study since 1967 when it was established.
Okay. Are there any questions for Cynthia?
Did the start of B lead to an increase in yield as well as an increase in early growth?
It often does. It depends, of course, on the question was, did the starter pea lead to an increase in yield as well as an increase in early growth? Some years it does, some years it doesn't. It certainly depends on the remainder of the growing season. But we do often see it translated into a yield response at the end, although not as often as we can see an impact on early growth.
You know, I do have a question. I grew up on these soils that are 10% calcium carbonate, Red River Valley soils in western Nebraska. How are these soils, and I assume Swiss current is got some higher pH and some calcium carbonate in there?
Yeah, yeah, it certainly does.
How are those conditions different than the Australian conditions that we were talking? Paul, you tried to start to answer that a little bit earlier. So in Australia, they're reporting that none of it goes into the organic and it's trapped in pretty tight. And your data is suggesting on these prairie soils, mm-hmm. The Great Plains soils, that it is pulling out.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just asking for discussion reasons and my own clarification, what's going on there? What's different? What's the condition?
Well,
I just add to that, because if you look at the west side of England, where we've got our chalk soils, we can increase the LCP in those soils quite readily, and this was done way back in the 60s, and get the sort of critical values that we can find in our other soils. So there is, Paul's right, I think there's a big dichotomy here, which we ought to try to resolve, but why is the Australian soils behaving so differently? Your soils, which are slightly calcareous, ours, which are slightly calcareous, pH of about 8 usually, and the soils that Cindy's been talking about.
I suppose I would ask, what's the total pH of the soils to start with? I mean, is there a big pool behind those buffer soils?
Yeah. Yeah. Now, we certainly don't see the building up and depletion that rapidly. Like ours, you can see it's very a very gradual build up and Even we're in some older studies that were done back in the 70s by Spratt and Reed, I think it was, they were putting on very massive amounts of phosphorus fertilizer and looking at depletion over time, and certainly not huge changes or huge depletion, even with relatively high rates, like tons of phosphate. Oh, no.
These things, it's almost been rattling in my mind for over 25 years.
We used to hold cages like those and pay our systems, and the farmers would have very soils because they get very high soil test values, like 50, 60, and yet the crops are still feed efficient. Part of that is because the soils are quite fluffy, they're very low level density. So we do a secondly, the cobalt dissolves up too much of the residual calcium phosphates in the system. And we've shown that with our isotope techniques, it dissolves up a lot of the calcium phosphates. It's designed to do that. The old syringe of the pH is designed to do that. But it's probably dissolving too much of those in relation to what we because resin techniques, whether it's beads or PRS coats or whatever, they give a much better relationship to crop response to fertilizing.
Cindy, do you know the calcium carbonate content?
Not specifically on the swift current. I should have taken a look at it, but
maybe around 8%.
Yeah, like it's not highly calcareous. It's not one of the more calcareous areas, but you know, certainly there are areas like that on the prairies. Nothing like what Mike is talking about. But we do have calcareous soils. You know, certainly when you look at the difference between, again, the Australian situation where their soils are like millions of years old and ours in the Canadian prairies where the soils are like 10,000 years old, our cation exchange capacities tend to be quite different. The organic matter content is different. It is, and our soils stay young because of the cold temperatures as well. So it's a very different dynamic, and as you're well aware. And so there's a lot of different things that are contributing to the difference in how the soils behave.
I think the other thing you have too much crop demand, the more soils are quite hot. I've started moving that summer into the winter growing periods. My soils are quite hot, it's moisture in it, whereas your soils are moist and temperature in it.
Mm-hmm.
So we have quite a rapid growth at the start of our season, a peak flush of growth, and that will slow down all day towards the later in the season. So the crop demand is really quite important as well. And the other thing you say is not a lot of Australia. So we've got the soils in the 80s, we've got high soil test values, and our P efficiency in the balance method is up around 100%, in fact, so high soil test values. So that was just for us, very dry land up here, so don't go away thinking all Australia, we've seen the phosphorus.
And you all hunt kangaroos too.
Any other questions of any of the authors?
Could I make a comment that I'd like to have made before, and sorry when I was making that presentation, and I showed those critical values for oats and people, winter wheat and winter spring barley, changing between season, and it was a question that somebody asked after the presentation. If we ban and can see that the critical value changes between the various P indices we use on a year-by-year basis, in a sense, it says how you use them. And what we're trying to do at the moment, I think, is say, here's a risk assessment. If you maintain your soil at the very highest level, then you're never going to suffer an adverse yield effect. But there may be some years in which you could have worked at a lower level. So in a sense, what we're saying to farmers, this is the range that we get in our optimum yields in relation to oats and pea. It's up to you to make the choice where you keep your value and you've a risk assessment. So that if you go for a middle value, there'll be 5 years out of 10 when you would not have had such a high value in the soil, but there'll be 5 years out of 10 when you will have lost yield because you didn't have that value. And I think this puts the onus then back to the farmer to make a risk assessment on his judgment on the basis of what we can show experimentally. And I think this brings back the whole thing to a cycle, if you like. It brings the farmer back into the system and says, the choice is yours. Here's the evidence. You make the choice in relation to your financial implications it will have for your farming system. And I don't think any of us, I think we would all agree here, we can't tell the farmer what to do in relation to his farming system in terms of finance. At the end, it's up to him to be profitable or otherwise.
I think it's in relation to that comment. There's actually another way to look at that. If you go back to a slightly different way, because of the plant water availability and the probability of the rainfall, you would adjust your fertilizer application knowing that I need a critical value. So it's similar, so if I put it the other way, more of the onus back on the grower.